That ain't your worry. Glanton might come back. He might. Tate looked over to where the Mexican was lying, and he looked at the kid again. I'm still held to it, he said. The kid didn't answer. You know what they'll do to him. The kid spat. I can guess, he said. No, you can't. I said you could go. You'd do what you want. Tate rose and looked to the south, but the desert there lay in all its clarity, uninhabited by any approaching armies. He shrugged up his shoulders in the cold. Injuns, he said. It don't mean nothing to them. He crossed the campground and brought his horse around and led it up and mounted it. He looked at the Mexican wheezing softly, a pink froth on his lips. He looked at the kid, and then he nudged the pony up through the scraggly acacia and was gone. The kid sat on the sand and stared off to the south. The Mexican was shot through the lungs and would die anyway. But Shelby had had his hip shattered by a ball, and he was clear in his head. He lay watching the kid. He was from a prominent Kentucky family and had attended Transylvania College. And like many another young man of his class, he'd gone west because of a woman. He watched the kid, and he watched the enormous sun where it sat boiling on the edge of the desert. Any road agent or gambler would have known that the first to speak would lose, but Shelby had already lost it all. Why don't you just get on with it? He said. The kid looked at him. If I had a gun, I'd shoot you, Shelby said. The kid didn't answer. You know that, don't you? You ain't got a gun, the kid said. He looked to the south again. Something moving, perhaps the first lines of heat. No dust in the morning so early. When he looked at Shelby again, Shelby was crying. You won't thank me if I let you off, he said. Do it then, you son of a bitch! The kid sat. A light wind was blowing out of the north, and some doves had begun to call in the thicket of greasewood behind them. If you want me just to leave you, I will. Shelby didn't answer. He pushed a furrow in the sand with the heel of his boot. You'll have to say. Will you leave me a gun? You know I can't leave you no gun. You know better than him, are you? The kid didn't answer. What if he comes back? Glanton? Yes. What if he does? He'll kill me. You won't be out nothing. You son of a bitch. The kid rose. Will you hide me? Hide you? Yes. The kid spat. You can't hide. Where are you going to hide at? Will he come back? I don't know. This is a terrible place to die in. Where's a good one? Shelby wiped his eyes with the back of his wrist. Can you see them? He said. Not yet. Will you pull me up under that bush? The kid turned and looked at him. He looked off down country again, and then he crossed the basin and squatted behind Shelby and took him up under the arms and raised him. Shelby's head rolled back, and he looked up, and then he snatched at the butt of the pistol stuck in the kid's belt. The kid seized his arm. He let him down and stepped away and turned him loose. When he returned through the basin leading the horse, the man was crying again. He took the pistol from his belt and jammed it among his belongings lashed to the cantle, and took his canteen down and went to him. He had his face turned away. The kid filled his flask from his own and reseated the stopper where it hung by its thong and drove it home with the heel of his hand. Then he rose and looked off to the south. Yonder they come, he said. Shelby raised up on one elbow. The kid looked at him, and he looked at the faint and formless articulation along the horizon to the south. Shelby lay back, He was staring up at the sky. A dark overcast was moving down from the north, and the wind was up. A clutch of leaves scuttled out of the willow bracken at the edge of the sand, and then scuttled back again. The kid crossed to where the horse stood waiting, and took the pistol, and stuck it in his belt, and hung the canteen over the saddle horn, and mounted up, and looked back at the wounded man. Then he rode out. He was trotting north on the plain when he saw another horseman on the grounds before him, perhaps a mile distant. He couldn't make him out, and he rode more slowly. After a while he saw that the rider was leading the horse, and after a while he could see that the horse was not walking right. It was Tate. He sat by the wayside watching the kid as he rode up. The horse stood on three legs. Tate said nothing. He took off his hat and looked inside it and put it on again. The kid was turned in the saddle, and he was looking to the south. Then he looked at Tate. "Can he walk?" "Not much." He got down and drew up the horse's leg. The frog of the hoof was split and bloody, and the animal's shoulder quivered. He let the hoof down. The sun was about 2 hours high, and now there was dust on the horizon. He looked at Tate. "What do you want to do?"
"I don't know. Lead him a while, see how he does."
"He ain't going to do."
"I know it."
"We could ride and tie."
"You might just keep riding."
"I might anyway." Tate looked at him.
"Go on if you want," he said.
The kid spat.
"Come on," he said. "I hate to leave the saddle. Hate to leave the horse, far as that goes."
The kid picked up the trailing reins of his own animal.
"You might change your mind about what you hate to leave," he said.
They set out, leading both horses. The damaged animal kept wanting to stop. Tate coaxed it along.
"Come on, fool," he said. "You ain't gonna like them niggers a bit more than me."
By noon the sun was a pale blur overhead, and a cold wind was blowing out of the north. They leaned into it, man and animal. The wind bore stinging bits of grit, and they set their hats low over their faces and pushed on. Dried desert chaff passed along with the seething migrant sands. Another hour, and there was no track visible from the main party of riders before them. The sky lay gray and of a piece in every direction as far as they could see, and the wind did not abate. After a while, it began to snow. The kid had taken down his blanket and wrapped himself in it. He turned and stood with his back to the wind, and the horse leaned and laid its cheek against his. His eyelashes were thatched with snow. When Tate came up, he stopped, and they stood looking out downwind where the snow was blowing. They could see no more than a few feet.
"Ain't this hell?" he said. "Will your horse lead?"
"Hell no. I can't hardly make him foller.
We get turned around, we might just run plumb into the Spaniards."
"I never saw it turn so cold so quick."
"What do you want to do?"
"We better go on. We could pull for the high country. As long as we keep going uphill, we'll know we ain't got in a circle. We'll get cut off. We never will find Glanton. We're cut off now."
Tate turned and stared bleakly to where the whirling flakes blew down from the north.
"Let's go," he said. "We can't stand here."
They led the horses on. Already the ground was white. They took turns riding the good horse and leading the lame. They climbed for hours up a long, rocky wash, and the snow did not diminish. They began to come upon pinyon and dwarf oak and open parkland, and the snow on those high meadows was soon a foot deep, and the horses were blowing and smoking like steam engines, and it was colder and growing dark. They were rolled in their blankets asleep in the snow, when the scouts from Elias's forward company came upon them.
They'd ridden all night, the only track there was, pushing on not to lose the march of those shallow pans as they filled with snow. There were five men, and they came up through the evergreens in the dark, and all but stumbled upon the sleepers. Two mounds in the snow, one of which broke open, and up out of which a figure sat suddenly, like some terrible hatching. The snow had stopped falling. The kid could see them and their animals clearly on that pale ground, the men in mid-stride and the horses blowing cold. He had his boots in one hand and his pistol in the other, and he came up out of the blanket and leveled the pistol and discharged it into the chest of the man nearest him and turned to run. His feet slid and he went to one knee. A musket fired behind him. He rose again, running down a darkened slash of pinyon and turning out along the face of the slope. There were other shots behind him, and when he turned, he could see a man coming down through the trees. The man stopped and raised his elbows, and the kid dove headlong. The musket ball went racketing off among the branches. He rolled over and cocked his pistol. The barrel must have been full of snow, because when he fired, a hoop of orange light sprang out about it, and the shot made a strange sound. He felt to see if the gun had burst, but it hadn't. He couldn't see the man anymore, and he picked himself up and ran on. At the foot of the slope, he sat gasping in the cold air, and pulled on the boots and watched back among the trees. Nothing moved. He rose and stuck the pistol in his belt and went on. The rising sun found him crouched under a rocky promontory, watching the country to the south. He sat so for an hour or more. A group of deer moved up the far side of the arroyo, feeding, and feeding, moved on. After a while he rose and went along the ridge. He walked all day through those wild uplands, eating handfuls of snow from the evergreen boughs as he went. He followed game trails through the firs, and in the evening he hiked along the rim rock, where he could see the tilted desert to the southwest, patched with shapes of snow, that roughly reproduced the patterns of cloud cover already moved on to the south. Ice had frozen on the rock, and the myriad of icicles among the conifers glistened blood red in the reflected light of the sunset spread across the prairie to the west. He sat with his back to a rock and felt the warmth of the sun on his face and watched it pool and flare and drain away, dragging with it all that pink and rose and crimson sky. An icy wind sprang up and the junipers darkened suddenly against the snow, and then there was just stillness and cold. He rose and moved on, hurrying along the shaly rocks. He walked all night. The stars swung counterclockwise in their course, and the Great Bear turned, and the Pleiades winked in the very roof of the vault. He walked until his toes grew numb and fairly rattled in his boots. His path upon the rimrock was leading him deeper into the mountains, along the edge of a great gorge, and he could see no place to descend out of that country. He sat and wrestled off the boots and held his frozen feet each by turn in his arms. They didn't warm, and his jaw was in a seizure of cold, and when he went to put the boots back on again, his feet were like clubs to poke into them. When he got them on and stood up and stamped numbly, he knew that he could not stop again until the sun rose. It grew colder, and the night lay long before him. He kept moving, following in the darkness the naked chines of rock, blown bare of snow. The stars burned with a lidless fixity, and they drew nearer in the night until toward dawn he was stumbling among the windstones of the uttermost ridge to heaven, a barren range of rock so enfolded in that gaudy house that stars lay awash at his feet, and migratory spalls of burning matter crossed constantly about him on their chartless reckonings. In the pre-dawn light he made his way out upon a promontory, and there received first of any creature in that country the warmth of the sun's ascending. He slept curled among the stones, the pistol clutched to his chest. His feet thawed and burned, and he woke and lay staring up at a sky of china blue, where very high there circled two black hawks about the sun, slowly and perfectly opposed, like paper birds upon a pole. He moved north all day, and in the long light of the evening he saw from that high rimland the collision of armies remote and silent upon the plain below. The dark little horses circled, and the landscape shifted in the paling light, and the mountains beyond brooded in darkening silhouette. The distant horsemen rode and parried, and a faint drift of smoke passed over them, and they moved on up the deepening shade of the valley floor, leaving behind them the shapes of mortal men who had lost their lives in that place. He watched all this pass below him, mute and ordered and senseless, until the warring horsemen were gone in the sudden rush of dark that fell over the desert. All that land lay cold and blue and without definition, and the sun shone solely on the high rocks where he stood. He moved on, and soon he was in darkness himself, and the wind came up off the desert, and frayed wires of lightning stood again and again along the western terminals of the world. He made his way along the escarpment until he came to a break in the wall cut through by a canyon running back into the mountains. He stood looking down into this gulf where the tops of the twisted evergreens hissed in the wind, and then he started down. The snow lay in deep pockets on the slope, and he floundered down through them, steadying himself along the naked rocks until his hands were numb with cold. He crossed with care a gravel slide and made his way down the far side among the rubble stone and small gnarled trees. He fell and fell again, scrabbling for a hand purchase in the dark, rising and feeling in his belt for the pistol. He was at this work the night long. When he reached the benchland above the canyon floor, he could hear a stream running in the gorge below him, and he went stumbling along with his hands in his armpits like a fugitive in a madman's waistcoat. He reached a sandy wash and followed it down, and it took him at last out upon the desert again, where he stood tottering in the cold and casting about dumbly for some star in the overcast. Most of the snow had blown or melted from off the plain on which he found himself. Tandem storms were blowing down country from the north, and the thunder trundled away in the distance, and the air was cold and smelled of wet stone. He struck out across the barren pan, nothing but sparse tufts of grass and the widely scattered palmilla, standing solitary and silent against the lowering sky like other beings posted there. To the east the mountains stood footed blackly into the desert, and before him were bluffs or promontories that ran out like headlands, massive and somber upon the desert floor. He clopped on woodenly, half-frozen, his feet senseless. He'd been without food for almost 2 days, and he'd had little rest. He sighted the terrain before him in the periodic flare of the lightning, and trudged on, and in this manner he rounded a dark cape of rock off to his right, and came to a halt, shivering and blowing into his clawed and palsied hands. In the distance before him a fire burned on the prairie, a solitary flame frayed by the wind that freshened and faded and shed scattered sparks down the storm like hot scurf blown from some unreckonable forge howling in the waste. He sat and watched it. He couldn't judge how far it was. He lay on his stomach to skylight the terrain to see what men were there, but there was no sky and no light. He lay for a long time watching, but he saw nothing move. When he went on again, the fire seemed to recede before him. A troop of figures passed between him and the light. Then again, wolves, perhaps. He went on. It was a lone tree burning on the desert, a heraldic tree that the passing storm had left afire. The solitary pilgrim drawn up before it had traveled far to be here, and he knelt in the hot sand and held his numbed hands out
while all about in that circle attended companies of lesser auxiliaries routed forth into the inordinate day. Small owls that crouched silently and stood from foot to foot, and tarantulas, and salpugas, and vinegaroons, and the vicious miggly spiders, and beaded lizards with mouths black as a chow dog's, deadly to man, and the little desert basilisks that jet blood from their eyes, and the small sand vipers, like seemly gods, silent and the same, in Jeddah in Babylon. A constellation of ignited eyes that edged the ring of light, all bound in a precarious truce before this torch, whose brightness had set back the stars in their sockets. When the sun rose, he was asleep, under the smoldering skeleton of a blackened scrog. The storm had long passed off to the south, and the new sky was raw and blue, and the spire of smoke from the burnt tree stood vertically in the still dawn, like a slender stylus marking the hour with its particular and faintly breathing shadow upon the face of a terrain that was without other designation. All the creatures that had been at vigil with him in the night were gone, and about him lay only the strange coral shapes of fulgurite in their scorched furrows, fused out of the sand where ball lightning had run upon the ground in the night, hissing and stinking of sulfur. Seated tailor-wise in the eye of that cratered waste, he watched the world tend away at the edges to a shimmering surmise that ringed the desert round. After a while he rose and made his way to the edge of the pan and up the dry course of an arroyo, following the small demonic tracks of javelinas, until he came upon them, drinking at a standing pool of water. They flushed, snorting into the chaparral, and he lay in the wet, trampled sand, and drank, and rested, and drank again. In the afternoon, he started across the valley floor with the weight of the water swinging in his gut. 3 hours later, he stood in the long arc of horse tracks coming up from the south where the party had passed. He followed the edge of the tracks and sorted out single riders, and he reckoned their number, and he reckoned them to be riding at a canter. He followed the trace for several miles, and he could tell by the alternation of tracks ridden over that all these riders had passed together. And he could tell by the small rocks overturned and holes stepped into that they had passed in the night. He stood looking out from under his hand long down country for any dust or rumor of Elias. There was nothing. He went on. A mile further he came upon a strange blackened mass in the trail, like a burnt carcass of some ungodly beast. He circled it. The tracks of wolves and coyotes had walked through the horse and boot prints, little sallies and sorties that fetched up to the edge of that incinerated shape and flared away again. It was the remains of the scalps taken on the Nacosari, and they had been burned unredeemed in a green and stinking bonfire, so that nothing remained of the Poblanos save this charred coagulate of their preterite lives. The cremation had been sited upon a rise of ground, and he studied every corner of the terrain about, but there was nothing to be seen. He went on, following the tracks with their suggestion of pursuit and darkness, trailing them through the deepening twilight. With sunset it grew cold, yet nothing like so cold as in the mountains. His fast had weakened him, and he sat on the sand to rest and woke sprawled and twisted on the ground. The moon was up, a half-moon that sat like a child's boat in the gap of the black paper mountains to the east. He rose and went on. Coyotes were yapping out there, and his feet reeled beneath him. An hour more of such progress, and he came upon a horse. It had been standing in the trace, and had moved off in the dark and stood again. He halted with his pistol drawn. The horse went past, a dark shape, rider or none, he could not tell. It circled and came back. He spoke to it. He could hear its deep pulmonary breathing out there, and he could hear it move and when it came back, he could smell it. He followed it about for the better part of an hour, talking to it, whistling, holding out his hands. When he got near enough to touch it at last, he took hold of it by the mane, and it went trotting as before, and he ran alongside and clung to it, and finally wrapped his legs about one foreleg and brought it to the ground in a heap. He was the first up. The animal was struggling to rise, and he thought it was injured in the fall, but it wasn't. He cinched his belt about its muzzle and mounted it, and it rose and stood trembling under him with its legs spread. He patted it along the withers and spoke to it, and it moved forward uncertainly. He reckoned it one of the pack horses purchased in Uris. It stopped, and he urged it forward, but it didn't go. He brought his boot heels sharply up under its ribs, and it squatted on its hindquarters and went crabbing sideways. He reached and undid the belt from its muzzle and kicked it forward and gave it a whack with the belt, and it stepped out right smartly. He twisted a good handful of the mane in his fist and jammed the pistol securely in his waist and rode on. Perched upon the raw spine of the animal, with the vertebra articulating palpable and discreet under the hide. In their riding, they were joined by another horse that came off the desert and walked alongside them, and it was still there when dawn broke. In the night, too, the tracks of the riders had been joined by a larger party, and it was a broad and trampled causeway that now led up the valley floor to the north. With daylight, he leaned down with his face against the horse's shoulder and studied the tracks. They were unshod Indian ponies, and there were perhaps 100 of them. Nor had they joined the riders, but rather been joined by them. He pushed on. The little horse that had come to them in the night had moved off some leagues, and now paced them with a watchful eye, and the horse he rode was nervous and ill for want of water. By noon, the animal was failing. He tried to coax it out of the track to catch the other horse, but it wouldn't quit the course it was set upon. He sucked on a pebble and surveyed the countryside. Then he saw riders ahead of him. They'd not been there, then they were there. He realized it was their vicinity that was the source of the unrest in the two horses, and he rode on, watching now the animals and now the skyline to the north. The hack that he straddled trembled and pushed ahead, and after a while he could see that the riders wore hats. He urged the horse on, and when he rode up, the party were halted and seated on the ground, all watching his approach. They looked bad. They were used up and bloody and black about the eyes, and they had bound up their wounds with linens that were filthy and blood-stained, and their clothes were crusted with dried blood and powder black. Glanton's eyes in their dark sockets were burning centroids of murder, and he and his haggard riders stared balefully at the kid as if he were no part of them, for all they were so like in wretchedness of circumstance. The kid slid down from the horse and stood among them, gaunt and parched and crazed-looking. Someone threw him a canteen. They had lost 4 men. The others were ahead on scout. Elias had forced on through the mountains all night and all the day following, and had ridden upon them through the snow in the dark on the plain 40 miles to the south. They'd been harried north over the desert like cattle, and had deliberately taken the track of the war party in order to lose their pursuers. They didn't know how far the Mexicans were behind them, and they didn't know how far the Apaches were ahead. He drank from the canteen and looked them over. Of the missing, he'd no way of knowing which were ahead with the scouts and which were dead in the desert. The horse that Toadvine brought him was the one the recruit Sloat had ridden out of Uris. When they moved out a half hour later, 2 of the horses would not rise and were left behind. He sat a hideless and rickety saddle astride the dead man's horse, and he rode slumped and tottering, and soon his legs and arms were dangling, and he jostled along in his sleep like a mounted marionette. He woke to find the ex-priest alongside him. He slept again. When he woke next, it was the judge was there. He, too, had lost his hat and rode with a woven wreath of desert scrub about his head, like some egregious saltland bard. And he looked down upon the refugee with the same smile, as if the world were pleasing even to him alone. They rode all the rest of that day, up through low rolling hills covered with chulla and whitethorn. From time to time one of the spare horses would stop and stand swaying in the track and grow small behind them. They rode down a long north slope in the cold blue evening, and through a barren bajada, grown only with sporadic ocotillo and stands of grama. And they made camp in the flat, and all night the wind blew, and they could see other fires burning on the desert to the north. The judge walked out and looked over the horses, and selected from that sorry remuda the animal least likely in appearance, and caught it up. He led it past the fire and called for someone to come hold it. No one rose. The ex-priest leaned to the kid. "Pay him no mind, lad." The judge called again from the dark beyond the fire, and the ex-priest placed a cautionary hand upon the kid's arm. But the kid rose and spat into the fire. He turned and eyed the ex-priest. "You think I'm afraid of him?" The ex-priest didn't answer, and the kid turned and went out into the darkness where the judge waited. He stood holding the horse. Just his teeth glistened in the firelight. Together they led the animal off a little ways, and the kid held the woven reata, while the judge took up a round rock weighing perhaps 100 pounds and crushed the horse's skull with a single blow. Blood shot out of its ears, and it slammed to the ground so hard that one of its forelegs broke under it with a dull snap. They skinned out the hindquarters without gutting the animal, and the men cut steaks from it and roasted them over the fire, and cut the rest of the meat in strips and hung it to smoke. The scouts did not come in, and they posted vedettes and turned in to sleep, each man with his weapon at his breast. Mid-morning of the day following, they crossed an alkali pan whereon were convoked an assembly of men's heads. The company halted, and Glanton and the judge rode forward. The heads were 8 in number, and each wore a hat, and they formed a ring all facing outward. Glanton and the judge circled them, and the judge halted and stepped down and pushed over one of the heads with his boot. As if to satisfy himself that no man stood buried in the sand beneath it. The other heads glared blindly out of their wrinkled eyes, like fellows of some righteous initiate, given up to vows of silence and of death. The riders looked off to the north. They rode on. Beyond a shallow rise in cold ash lay the blackened wreckage of a pair of wagons and the nude torsos of the party. The wind had shifted the ashes, and the iron axle trees marked the shapes of the wagons as keelsons do the bones of ships on the sea's floors. The bodies had been partly eaten, and rooks flew up as the riders approached, and a pair of buzzards began to trot off across the sand with their wings outheld like soiled coreens, their boiled-looking heads jerking obscenely. They went on. They crossed a dry estuary of the desert flat, and in the afternoon they rode up through a series of narrow defiles into a rolling hill country. They could smell the smoke of pinyon wood fires, and before dark they rode into the town of Santa Cruz. This town, like all the presidios along the border, was much reduced from its former estate, and many of the buildings were uninhabited and ruinous. The coming of the riders had been cried before them, and the way stood lined with inhabitants, watching dumbly as they passed. The old women in black rebosos, and the men armed with old muskets and miquelets, or guns fabricated out of parts rudely let into stocks of cottonwood that had been shaped with axes, like clubhouse guns for boys. There were even guns among them with no locks at all, that were fired by jamming a cigarillo against the vent in the barrel, sending the gunstones from the riverbed with which they were loaded whistling through the air on flights of their own eccentric selection, like the paths of meteorites. The Americans pushed their horses forward. It had begun to snow again, and a cold wind blew down the narrow street before them. Even in their wretched state, they glared from their saddles at this Falstaffian militia with undisguised contempt. They stood among their horses in the squalid little Alameda, while the wind ransacked the trees, and the birds nesting in the gray twilight cried out and clutched the limbs, and the snow swirled and blew across the little square and shrouded the shapes of the mud buildings beyond, and made mute the cries of the vendors who'd followed them. Glanton and the Mexican he'd set out with returned, and the company mounted up and filed out down the street until they came to an old wooden gate that led into a courtyard. The courtyard was dusted with snow, and within were contained barnyard fowl and animals, goats, a burro, that clawed and scrabbled blindly at the walls as the riders entered. In one corner stood a tripod of blackened sticks, and there was a large bloodstain that had been partly snowed over and showed a faint pale rose in the last light. A man came out of the house, and he and Glanton spoke, and the man talked with the Mexican, and then he motioned them in out of the weather. They sat on the floor of a long room with a high ceiling and smoke-stained vigas, while a woman and a girl brought bowls of guisado made from goat and a clay plate heaped with blue tortillas, and there were served bowls of beans and of coffee and a cornmeal porridge, in which sat little chunks of raw brown peloncillo sugar. Outside it was dark, and the snow swirled down. There was no fire in the room, and the food steamed ponderously. When they had eaten, they sat smoking, and the women gathered up the bowls, and after a while a boy came with a lantern and led them out. They crossed the yard among the snuffling horses, and the boy opened a rough wooden door in an adobe shed and stood by holding a lamp aloft. They brought their saddles and their blankets. In the yard, the horses stamped in the cold. The shed held a mare with a suckling colt, and the boy would have put her out, but they called to him to leave her. They carried straw from a stall and pitched it down, and he held the lamp for them while they spread their bedding. The barn smelled of clay and straw and manure, and in the soiled yellow light of the lamp their breath rolled smoking through the cold. When they had arranged their blankets, the boy lowered the lamp and stepped into the yard and pulled the door shut behind, leaving them in profound and absolute darkness. No one moved. In that cold stable, the shutting of the door may have evoked in some hearts other hostiles, and not of their choosing. The mare sniffed uneasily, and the young colt stepped about. Then one by one they began to divest themselves of their outer clothes, the hide slickers and raw wool serapes and vests, and one by one they propagated about themselves a great crackling of sparks, and each man was seen to wear a shroud of palest fire. Their arms aloft, pulling at their clothes, were luminous, and each obscure soul was enveloped in audible shapes of light, as if it had always been so. The mare at the far end of the stable snorted and shied at this luminosity in being so endarkened, and the little horse turned and hid his face in the web of his dam's flank. Chapter 16. The Santa Cruz Valley. San Bernardino. Wild Bulls. Tumacuckery. The Mission. A Hermit. Tubac. The Lost Scouts. San Javier del Bac. The Presidio of Tucson. Scavengers. The Chiricahuas. A Risky Encounter. Mangas Colorado. Lieutenant Couts. Recruiting in the Plaza. A Wild Man. Murder of Owens. In the Cantina. Mr. Bell is examined. The Judge on Evidence. Dog Freaks. A Fandango. Judge and the Meteorite. It was colder yet in the morning when they rode out. There was no one in the streets, and there were no tracks in the new snow. At the edge of town, they saw where wolves had crossed the road. They rode out by a small river, skim ice, a frozen marsh where ducks walked up and back, muttering. That afternoon, they traversed a lush valley where the dead winter grass reached to the horses' bellies. Empty fields where the crops had rotted, and orchards of apple and quince and pomegranate where the fruit had dried and fallen to the ground. They found deer yarded up in the meadows, and the tracks of cattle. And that night as they sat about their fire, roasting the ribs and haunches of a young doe, they could hear the lowing of bulls in the dark. The following day they rode past the ruins of the old hacienda at San Bernardino. On that range they saw wild bulls so old that they bore Spanish brands on their hips. And several of these animals charged the little company, and were shot down and left on the ground, until one came out of a stand of acacia in a wash and buried its horns to the boss in the ribs of a horse ridden by James Miller. He'd lifted his foot out of the near stirrup when he saw it coming, and the impact all but jarred him from the saddle. The horse screamed and kicked, but the bull had planted its feet, and it lifted the animal, rider and all, clear of the ground before Miller could get his pistol free. And when he put the muzzle to the bull's forehead and fired, and the whole grotesque assembly collapsed, he stepped clear of the wreckage and walked off in disgust, with the smoking gun dangling in his hand. The horse was struggling to rise, and he went back and shot it, and put the gun in his belt, and commenced to unbuckle the girth straps. The horse was lying square atop the dead bull, and it took him some tugging to get the saddle free. The other riders had stopped to watch, and someone hazed forward the last spare horse out of the remuda, but other than that they offered him no help. They rode on, following the course of the Santa Cruz up through stands of immense river-bottom cottonwoods. They didn't cut the sign of the Apache again, and they found no trace of the missing scouts. The following day they passed the old mission at San Jose de Tumacocory, and the judge rode off to look at the church, which stood about a mile off the track. He'd given a short disquisition on the history and architecture of the mission, and those who heard it would not believe that he had never been there. Three of the party rode with him, and Glanton watched them go with dark misgiving. He and the others rode on a short distance, and then he halted and turned back. The old church was in ruins, and the door stood open to the high-walled enclosure. When Glanton and his men rode through the crumbling portal, four horses stood riderless in the empty compound among the dead fruit trees and grapevines. Glanton rode with his rifle upright before him, the butt plate on his thigh. His dog heeled to the horse, and they approached cautiously the sagging walls of the church. They would have ridden their horses through the door, but as they reached it there was a rifle shot from inside and pigeons flapped up, and they slipped down from their mounts and crouched behind them with their rifles. Glanton looked back at the others and then walked his horse forward to where he could see into the interior. Part of the upper wall was fallen in, and most of the roof, and there was a man lying in the floor. Glanton led the horse into the sacristy and stood looking down with the others. The man in the floor was dying, and he was dressed altogether in homemade clothes of sheep-hide, even to boots and a strange cap. They turned him over on the cracked clay tiles, and his jaw moved, and a bloody spittle formed along his lower lip. His eyes were dull, and there was fear in them, and there was something else. John Pruitt stood the butt of his rifle in the floor and swung his horn about to recharge the piece.
"I seen another run," he said. "There's two of them."
The man on the floor began to move. He had one arm lying in his groin, and he moved it slightly and pointed. At them, or at the height from which he had fallen, or to his destination in eternity, they did not know. Then he died. Glanton looked about the ruins.
"Where'd this son of a bitch come from?" he said.
Pruitt nodded toward the crumbling mud parapet.
He's up yonder. I didn't know what he was. Still don't. I shot the son of a bitch out of there.
Glanton looked at the judge.
I think he was an imbecile, the judge said.
Glanton led his horse through the church and out by a small door in the nave into the yard. He was sitting there when they brought the other hermit out. Jackson prodded him forward with the barrel of his rifle, a small, thin man, not young. The one they'd killed was his brother. They had jumped ship on the coast long ago and made their way to this place. He was terrified, and he spoke no English and little Spanish. The judge spoke to him in German. They had been here for years. The brother had his wits stole in this place, and the man now before them in his hides and his peculiar booties was not altogether sane. They left him there. As they rode out, he was trotting up and back in the yard, calling out. He seemed not to be aware that his brother was dead in the church. The judge caught Glanton up, and they rode side by side out to the road. Glanton spat.
"Ought to shot that one, too," he said.
The judge smiled.
"I don't like to see white men that way," Glanton said. "Dutch or whatever, I don't like to see it."
They rode north along the river trace. The woods were bare, and the leaves on the ground clutched little scales of ice, and the mottled and bony limbs of the cottonwoods were stark and heavy against the quilted desert sky. In the evening they passed through Tubac, abandoned, wheat dead in the winter fields, and grass growing in the street. There was a blind man on a stoop watching the plaza, and as they passed he raised his head to listen. They rode out onto the desert to camp. There was no wind, and the silence out there was greatly favored by every kind of fugitive, as was the open country itself, and no mountains close at hand for enemies to black themselves against. They were caught up and saddled in the morning before light, all riding together, their arms at the ready. Each man scanned the terrain, and the movements of the least of creatures were logged into their collective cognizance, until they were federated with invisible wires of vigilance, and advanced upon that landscape with a single resonance. They passed abandoned haciendas and roadside graves, and by mid-morning they had picked up the track of the Apaches again and coming in off the desert to the west, and advancing before them through the loose sand of the river bottom. The riders got down and pinched up samples of the forced sand at the rim of the tracks, and tested it between their fingers, and calibrated its moisture against the sun, and let it fall, and looked off up the river through the naked trees. They remounted and rode on. They found the lost scouts, hanging head downward from the limbs of a fire-blacked Palo Verde tree. They were skewered through the cords of their heels with sharpened shuttles of green wood, and they hung gray and naked above the dead ashes of the coals, where they'd been roasted until their heads had charred and the brains bubbled in the skulls, and steam sang from their nose holes. Their tongues were drawn out and held with sharpened sticks thrust through them, and they had been docked of their ears, and their torsos were sliced open with flints until the entrails hung down on their chests. Some of the men pushed forward with their knives and cut the bodies down, and they left them there in the ashes. The two darker forms were the last of the Delawares, and the other two were the Van Diemenlander, and a man from the east named Gilchrist. Among their barbarous hosts they had met with neither favor nor discrimination, but had suffered and died impartially. They rode that night through the mission of San Javier del Bac, the church solemn and stark in the starlight. Not a dog barked. The clusters of Papago huts seemed without tenant. The air was cold and clear, and the country there and beyond lay in a darkness unclaimed by so much as an owl. A pale green meteor came up the valley floor behind them and passed overhead and vanished silently in the void. At dawn on the outskirts of the Presidio of Tucson, they passed the ruins of several haciendas, and they passed more roadside markers where people had been murdered. Out on the plain stood a small estancia, where the buildings were still smoking, and along the segments of a fence, constructed from the bones of cactus, sat vultures shoulder to shoulder, facing east to the promised sun, lifting one foot and then the other, and holding out their wings like cloaks. They saw the bones of pigs that had died in a clay-walled lot, and they saw a wolf in a melon patch that crouched between its thin elbows and watched them as they passed. The town lay on the plain to the north in a thin line of pale walls, and they grouped their horses along a low esker of gravel and surveyed it and the country, and the naked ranges of mountains beyond. The stones of the desert lay in dark tethers of shadow, and a wind was blowing out of the sun where it sat squat and pulsing at the eastern reaches of the earth. They chucked up their horses and sallied out onto the flat, as did the Apache track before them, 2 days old and 100 riders strong. They rode with their rifles on their knees, fanned out, riding abreast. The desert sunrise flared over the ground before them, and ringdoves rose out of the chaparral by ones and by pairs, and whistled away with thin calls. 1,000 yards out, and they could see the Apaches camped along the south wall. Their animals were grazing among the willows in the periodic river basin to the west of the town, and what seemed to be rocks or debris under the wall was the sordid collection of lean-tos and wickiups thrown up with poles and hides and wagon sheets. They rode on. A few dogs had begun to bark. Glanton's dog was quartering back and forth nervously, and a deputation of riders had set out from the camp. They were Chiricahuas. 20, 25 of them. Even with the sun up, it was not above freezing, and yet they sat their horses half-naked, naught but boots and breech-clouts, and the plumed hide helmets they wore, stone-age savages daubed with clay paints and obscure charges, greasy, stinking, the paint on the horses pale under the dust, and the horses prancing and blowing cold. They carried lances and bows, and a few had muskets, and they had long black hair and dead black eyes that cut among the riders studying their arms, the sclera bloodshot and opaque. None spoke even to another, and they shouldered their horses through the party in a sort of ritual movement, as if certain points of ground must be trod in a certain sequence as in a child's game, yet with some terrible forfeit at hand. The leader of these jackal warriors was a small dark man in cast-off Mexican military attire, and he carried a sword, and he carried in a torn and gaudy baldric one of the Whitneyville colts that had belonged to the scouts. He sat his horse before Glanton and assessed the position of the other riders, and then asked in good Spanish where were they bound. He'd no sooner spoken than Glanton's horse leaned its jaw forward and seized the man's horse by the ear. Blood flew. The horse screamed and reared, and the Apache struggled to keep his seat and drew his sword, and found himself staring into the black lemniscate that was the paired bores of Glanton's double rifle. Glanton slapped the muzzle of his horse twice hard, and it tossed its head with one eye blinking and blood dripping from its mouth. The Apache wrenched his pony's head around, and when Glanton spun to look at his man, he found them frozen in deadlock with the savages, they and their arms wired into a construction, taut and fragile, as those puzzles wherein the placement of each piece is predicated upon every other, and they in turn, so that none can move for bringing down the structure entire. The leader was the first to speak. He gestured at the bloodied ear of his mount and spoke angrily in Apache, his dark eyes avoiding Glanton. The judge pushed his horse forward.
"Vaya tranquilo," he said. "Un accidente, nada más."
"Mire," said the Apache. "Mire la oreja de mi caballo."
He steadied the animal's head to show it, but it jerked loose and slung the broken ear about so that blood sprayed the riders. Horse blood, or any blood, a tremor, ran that perilous architecture, and the ponies stood rigid and quivering in the reddened sunrise, and the desert under them hummed like a snare drum. The tensile properties of this unratified truce were abused to the utmost of their enduring when the judge stood slightly in the saddle and raised his arm and spoke out a greeting beyond them. Another 8 or 10 mounted warriors had ridden out from the wall. Their leader was a huge man with a huge head, and he was dressed in overalls cut off at the knees to accommodate the legging tops of his moccasins, and he wore a checked shirt and a red scarf. He carried no arms, but the men at either side of him were armed with short-barreled rifles, and they also carried the saddle pistols and other accoutrements of the murdered scouts. As they approached, the other savages deferred and gave way before them. The Indian, whose horse had been bitten, pointed out this injury to them, but the leader only nodded affably. He turned his mount quarterwise to the judge, and it arched its neck, and he sat it well.
"Buenos dias," he said. "De donde viene?"
The judge smiled and touched the withered garland at his brow, forgetting, possibly, that he had no hat. He presented his chief, Glanton, very formally. Introductions were exchanged. The man's name was Mangus, and he was cordial and spoke Spanish well. When the rider of the injured horse again put forth his claim for consideration, this man dismounted and took hold of the animal's head and examined it. He was bandy-legged for all his height, and he was strangely proportioned. He looked up at the Americans, and he looked at the other riders, and waved his hand at them.
"Andale," he said.
He turned to Glanton.
"Ellos son amigables. Un poco borracho, nada más."
The Apache riders had begun to extricate themselves from among the Americans like men backing out of a thorn thicket. The Americans stood their rifles upright, and Mangus led the injured horse forward and turned its head up, containing the animal solely with his hands, and the white eye rolling crazily. After some discussion, it became plain that whatever the assessment of damage levied, there was no specie acceptable by way of payment other than whiskey. Glanton spat and eyed the man.
"No eye, whiskey," he said.
Silence fell. The Apaches looked from one to the other. They looked at the saddle wallets and canteens and gourds.
"Cómo?" said Mangus. "No hay whiskey," said Glanton.
Mangus let go the rough hide headstall of the horse. His man watched him. He looked toward the walled town, and he looked at the judge.
"No whiskey," he said.
"No whiskey."
His, among the clouded faces, seemed unperturbed. He looked over the Americans, their gear. In truth, they did not look like men who might have whiskey they hadn't drunk. The judge and Glanton sat their mounts and offered nothing further in the way of parley.
"I whiskey in Tucson," said Mangus.
"Sin duda," said the judge. "Y soldados también."
He put forward his horse, his rifle in one hand and the reins in the other. Glanton moved. The horse behind him shifted into motion. Then Glanton stopped.
"Tiene oro?"
he said.
"Sí."
"Cuánto?"
"Bastante."
Glanton looked at the judge, then at Mangus again.
"Bueno,"
he said.
"Tres días, aquí. Un barril de whisky."
"Un barril?"
"Un barril."
He nudged the pony, and the Apaches gave way, and Glanton and the judge and those who followed rode single file toward the gates of the squalid mud town that sat burning in the winter sunrise on the plain. The lieutenant in charge of the little garrison was named Coutts. He had been to the coast with Major Graham's command, and returned here 4 days ago to find the town under an informal investment by the Apaches. They were drunk on tizween they'd brewed, and there had been shooting in the night 2 nights running, and an incessant clamor for whiskey. The garrison had a 12-pound demi-culverin loaded with musket balls mounted on the revetment, and Couch expected the savages would withdraw when they could get nothing more to drink. He was very formal, and he addressed Glanton as captain. None of the tattered partisans had even dismounted. They looked about at the bleak and ruinous town. A blindfolded burro tethered to a pole